you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is a podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, Amazon Prime, and my second feature is written. It's done. It's on the page.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. And I'm currently in pre-production on my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep and a distribution consultant, and I used to work at Sundance. This week, we welcome actor, producer, general lovely human, Deborah Lee Smith on the show to talk about freelance producing, acting, and how she balances her many jobs to get a sustainable career in filmmaking. She also talks about working as a producer on Butterfly in the Sky, the documentary about Reading Rainbow. After that, we play another round of The Game. But first, Alric, how are you?
I'm doing well. I had my first, like, investor meeting, kind of, for this movie, which
Huge.
It feels like way too soon to do
Huge.
That. Like, it's like, I just wrote it. I shouldn't have done it so quickly. But it was good. It was good. It was with, it basically was like a natural thing that happened because I had sent out K-1s to all my investors for The Alternate. And then I was like, and I got something else coming. So if you want to meet, let me know. And then, like, two people were like, yes, let's have that meeting. Aww. And I was like, oh, shite. Okay. But it went well. It was good. It was really nice chat. It was great to talk to this guy who was a really big supporter of the movie and, like, actually came out and did some, like, you know, photography for us and behind the scenes stills. Yeah, he was really great. It was awesome to hear that he's not mad at me. He doesn't hate me for not giving him his money back, that he, like, understands the way it goes, and he doesn't look at the movie as a failure. He thinks it was, like, you know, he's very proud of it and, like, excited with what it's done. And, you know, he obviously wants the next one to go better and to, like, have a return on his investment, which, you know, like, I also do. So we had a good conversation. He seemed very intrigued by my new movie, which is now currently called Ricky and the Ooze. That's the current title.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Pulp science fiction it's not good enough. It's like too on the nose, and
it could be a subtitle. It could be like the secondary title. It could be a tagline, right?
Yeah, I think some of the conversations I've had with people who read the script are like, it's fun to discover that it's a pulp fiction type movie while reading it rather than being told up front that it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that's why the title change was, like, important to a couple of people who read it. So yeah, Ricky and the Ooze, we're rocking with that for now. I missed a deadline last week for a submission, and I'm, like, kind of glad that I didn't do it because I feel like, you know, I'm happy I'm submitting it, but I do feel like it needs more work, and I'd rather put more time into it rather than just pushing it out, you know, to the next couple. I have two more I want to do.
Yeah.
Final Draft, Big Break, and I think it's Script Pipeline is what it's called. So those will be the two last in this round, and then I'll, like, just chill and wait to see. But I feel like, I don't know, like, if somebody comes in and is like, hey, I love this, here's some moolah, let's go. Like, this movie could be made to be made as soon as next year, I think. So we'll see. Or maybe even this year. I don't know. I'm not going to rule it out. It's not possible. But yeah, so things are going well. It's exciting. I feel like I don't know. I think I talked about this last week. Like, that it's like the hard part of the writing now. Like, I've gotten some notes back. I know the problems, and now I have to fix them. And it's like, This is really hard, and I'm like, have this huge fear, and it's like a barrier wall of between me and the script right now. It's like, I want to push through it and punch through and keep working on it, but, like, I also just need to respect the wall, like, for myself. So I'm just giving myself some space. I think I'll probably start to actually do some serious rewriting maybe this week, but definitely next week. But I'm still just like, it's just too big of a thing for me to, like, comprehend, like, going in and, like, making these huge changes. And I know I want to. So I'm just sort of, like, just giving it its space right now. Trying to watch some cool movies, enjoy movies. And I'm excited. I said last week, but I'm really excited to work with Amy on her movie. And I'm working on a documentary that I'm editing right now, which is fun. So it's, like, it's nice to be, like, doing some creative things, you know, that's, like, getting me in the system of filmmaking. But, like, just sort of gearing up to really go nuts and start making my movie. But yeah, what's going on with you? What's the latest on Best Friends Forever?
Well, just going back to what you said, I know that wall feeling very, very well. And by the way, Sean's polishing his script right now, and he I don't know. He feels like, I think, a barrier too. And so what I do, or what I'm encouraging him to do, is like, think of it almost like a homework assignment, almost transactional in nature, where you just create a really long to-do list of all the things that you want to do for your script. And then you don't necessarily do them. You do all the easy stuff first, and then you like take them off the list, right? You just like take it off the list, take the list. I don't know. I know what you're saying, and you might not even be ready to do the to-do list yet, but sometimes I feel like just overwhelmed when I can't quantify all the changes. But then if you're able to quantify them in a list, it feels less daunting to me. Like, oh, it's just these things. I'm just going to do these things on my own pace, right?
Yeah, totally. Well, I have another call this week with someone who read the script. So I'm going to get a bunch more, like, you know, clarity on notes and like some more detail on notes in a couple of days. So that'll be helpful. But yeah, I feel like I have a little bit of a list like in my mind. I haven't written it down, but maybe I should just write it down.
Write it down so you don't have to hold it there anymore, because that's also pressure, right? Is like trying to remember it all.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so what's going on with me? I'm watching things too. We're in the middle of Late Night with the Devil, which is so good. And I just like, it's so fun. I had my actor meeting last Friday.
Oh, how did it go?
It was awesome. It was like truly awesome. Like in the middle of it, I like, you know how you can kind of take yourself out of the situation and just kind of watch yourself. And it's like, I felt like I was flying. Like I was like, ooh, I'm flying. It was really fantastic. We talked for 2 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, she just got it. She was very curious. She asked me lots of questions about myself, about the script, about the direction, about the production. She was receptive to me asking her questions. She just came at it from such a like lovely, kind, generous spot. I don't know if I can say this, but I'm going to say this. So at the end of the meeting, she says to me, and I'm not going to give the name of the actress and I'm not going to give the name of the agency, but she says to me, I want you to know that I love the script and I love you and I love everything we just talked about, but I don't know how my agents are going to respond.
Oh.
And I was like, wow. Got it. Totally get it. Played this game before. Thank you for saying that. So wow. I think we're in this world where like we're waiting to see how the agents, what their next play is. And we're like so unimportant to them. Right. So I don't think they're going to get back to us and like share their plan anytime soon. But just acknowledging that it was a lovely meeting. It reinstated my faith in these kinds of meetings, but I'm still powerless. I'm still this like powerless pawn in the indie film economy. So we're waiting. More waiting.
Yeah. It's almost like you and the actor are like kind of equally at the mercy of what the agents want to do, you know, to some degree.
Yeah. I think she has sway with them, you know, and they're her agents. But I think she also, I'm sure it's a political game for her too. Like she doesn't want to go rogue or doesn't want to like not trust them. And then it's like, I understand that I'm not like the best choice for them. You know, they're not going to make lots of money off of me. And, you know, there's probably many reasons why they might not see me as a commodity for them.
Right.
But you're right. There was this interesting tie that we were both just waiting to hear back from her agents. So.
Yeah. I want to share a really short story of someone who I will not name that I worked with. And they had fancy agents at an agency I will not name.
Yeah.
And basically whatever the agent said, she would do. It was almost like she didn't have.
Yeah.
Like she had an opinion, you know, but like she was so excited to be working with these agents. And like she like even had said something to the effect of like, I have worked my whole career to have these agents. I'm not going to fuck up my relationship with my agents for this project. Yeah. Something like that, you know, and it's just like, but you could still have a fucking opinion. You know, you could still like voice what you want to them, or like, you know, you don't have to just like do exactly what the email says every time. But I don't know. I mean, hey, everybody has their different way of doing things. And to be fair, just in case this person's listening, like I don't really feel like they were doing like really. It wasn't like super bad, but it was just like, I don't know. I just feel like they could have pushed back a little bit at certain times where they weren't willing to. And I understand that. I get like you got to value your agents. But yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with your project.
Yeah, I want to know as well. But what I also would love is for everyone to head on over to our Patreon campaign, patreon.com/MMIH podcast. It's how we fuel this show. Every single dollar and cent matters. And thank you so much in advance for supporting us by listening and supporting us on Patreon. And without any more delay, here's our chat with Deborah Lee Smith.
Welcome, Deborah Lee Smith, to the show. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can you give us the elevator pitch for your film, Butterfly in the Sky?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a film about Reading Rainbow, the, you know, esteemed childhood show that I certainly watched a lot as a kid. And it basically tells the story of why the show was created and who created it. And of course, we touch on LeVar and why he was such an important host and spokesperson of the show. But we really like to center the film on the creators of it, because it was really created by this one woman who saw the need for child literacy to be brought up in, like, basically, you know, during that time, child literacy would really decline during the summer. And so they really felt like it was important to have some way of encouraging children to read during the summer. And so that is how it started. She was a school teacher and she ended up creating the show herself, and then had to fight for the whole duration of the show in order to keep it going. Because of course, you know, federal funding and all of that kind of stuff, like, it's difficult to fund films now. It's difficult to fund films then, especially, you know, anything that had some importance behind it. So that's really the important part of the film, is really the heart and the story behind the film, or behind the show.
The most important question to ask you is why LeVar Burton was not a Jeopardy host. Oh, like the full-time Jeopardy host.
I agree. He definitely should have 100%.
He should have.
Yes.
He should have won it. No, seriously, have given the series on like a silver platter and been like, here you go, LeVar.
Yeah. And you know, it's like, he has another film out that was on the festival circuit at the same time as ours, that's also about literacy. So like, this is clearly something that's like very important to him, not just because of Reading Rainbow, but also just because it's, you know, I mean, it has had such an important part of his life. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that he should host everything. He's so charming. So.
The real question is, for this documentary, how many days did you shoot?
I was a co-producer on it, and I was actually brought on. This was actually my first documentary. I produce mostly narratives, although I'm currently producing a second documentary. So clearly the tap has now been opened, but I'm usually a narrative maker. And so with this one, the main producer on that reached out to me because he was looking for someone to help with the travel portion of the documentary. And because I've done narratives, which is so all over the place, and you shoot in so many different places, and it's oftentimes not, you know, there's always things that go wrong. He was like, I think you'd be perfect for this. So with that, we shot 3 weeks with the travel portion. And so that was, we started in Buffalo, which is where Reading Rainbow started. That's where the studio is that filmed. So we started in Buffalo, New York, went to New York City, DC, Connecticut, some other little like tiny towns to interview people who were important executives and stuff on the show. And then went down to Florida, which is where both Twyla as well as the two executive producers on the show are still living. And so we kind of did a whole East Coast tour in order to capture all those people. And of course, we filmed LeVar in Los Angeles at the LA County Library, which was really special to be able to film in there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
If you can say, what was the rough budget of the film?
I can't say specifically, but I can say that it was under $1 million. And we were very lucky in that this was a film that was funded pretty much entirely by XTR, which is a really incredible documentary company. And so my producing partner on that, he had worked with them previously, and he's done a lot of like very scrappy indie documentaries that are like 300,000, under 500,000. And so with this one, I'll say it was more than that, but less than $1 million, somewhere in there.
Thanks for giving a low side of the range as well.
For sure.
So you kind of already talked about this, but I'd be curious for a little bit more color on how the project was brought to you. I get why you were brought on, but what was that first connection with the project?
So I'm very lucky, and I mean, I'll say I'm very lucky, but also I'm very strategic as far as like I really love connecting with people, and I'm really good at following up with people and maintaining relationships. And so like this was something where that producer has been a friend of mine for a while. He knows that I'm a narrative producer, and he actually when he was first approached with the project, because the directors approached him to the with the project, he came to me even before I was attached to it and was like asked if he should do it. And I was like, yeah, Reading Rainbow's awesome. Like, just as a friend. And so then, I mean, 6 months, 8 months later, when he needed some help, I think I was the obvious choice. And we had been looking for a project to work on together. So it just happened to happen that way. But, again, like I've had every project that I've been on has been someone who I have established a relationship with, and they've asked me to be a part of it because they've seen my work and they, know that I'm easy and fun to work with. And so then it just becomes like this wonderful collaboration, which I really love, instead of it being like I'm applying for a job. Like that has actually never been a thing for me, for better or for worse.
So from the moment you got brought on by your friend and the producer, how long did you spend working on the film from then till the movie came out?
Or is coming out.
Yeah, it's coming out. I mean, probably only like 3 months during the like pre-production, that shoot time, and helping them route out that post-production. Of course, I've been helping with cuts, watching cuts, giving notes, like all of that kind of stuff. But obviously, it's not been, I was really only, full transparency, I was only paid for the time when I was on set. So it was like I was paid a producer day rate when I was on set. Pre-production, post-production, notes, all of that kind of stuff is just indie filmmaking, helping out, giving, creative input as you do.
I'm feeling more and more like a grown up lately. Every day, more and more like an adult because I'm holding more and more children in my arms. I'm curious, I understand the yen to follow a commitment from beginning to end, but how are you able to kind of balance your schedule and your commitments with some of that unpaid work thrown into the mix?
Such a good question, Liz. I mean, that is the age-old question. And I would say, I mean, full transparency, I have a marketing company. So that is, I have a marketing company, which is also my production company. It's a content creation company, so it's all incorporated together. So that is how I fund my life. And then all so many of other things are unpaid. And so, I mean, even this new documentary that I'm on, that I'm, very excited about, that is also one where like I am basically like I'm putting funds in as a producer in order to make this documentary happen. There's deferred pay in it for me, and I believe in the project, which is why I'm doing it, but I'm certainly not getting paid at this right now. And I think that unfortunately, this is the same as like I know that on this podcast, you guys, you've talked to so many people, and I love listening to this podcast because there's such a breadth of people who have, people who have been in the studio system, and like that is how they're making their money, to people who, yeah, are working a restaurant job and then they save all of their money and then they put 50 grand into their first feature and then that goes to Sundance happenstance and then blows them up and so, like or not, like I think that the for me right now in all aspects of my career as an actor and as a writer and a producer, I am just like I am not putting the onus of making a living on the career because I can't. If I would have, I would have quit a long time ago. Instead, I've got other ways to fund my career, and then I work on those passion projects because that is what actually drives me. And I think that, with AI and everything that's happening right now, unfortunately, I think that more and more people are going to have to start doing this, where they have to, if they want to be a part of this business, they have to find another way to make money. And then this is just going to be something that fuels them and helps them wake up in the morning and is the thing that brings them happiness. Because I think unfortunately, it's really, we're going to be in a dark place, I think, for a while as far as being able to actually make a living in this industry.
Can you talk about that a little bit? Because, like, you know, I have a day job. Liz has her day job. Like, yeah. How do you manage your day job that pays the bills against, you know, being a producer and making and an actor and all and doing all yeah. these projects?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's really hard. I do a lot. I mean, the logistical way of it is that I'm pretty good at scheduling my life and having block scheduling so that I'll really like have times, you know, like 3 hours where I'm going to focus on this and then a couple hours where I'm going to focus on my creative things. Certainly having deadlines is very helpful for me. Obviously having creative collaborators is very helpful for me. So like with this documentary that I'm currently producing, you know, I have the things like we're actually gearing up for a Seed and Spark campaign in order to help the post-production funds on that. And so it's like, I'm handling that I can do at 10 p.m. at night until 1 in the morning. Like that is when I, you know, like I'm working all hours in order to get that stuff done. And I also have my boyfriend has 2 children. So I also have 2 children at home. So it's like that has honestly been the most difficult part was handling these marketing clients, handling all of my creative stuff, and then adding 2 children into the mix. Yeah, it's a lot. But I would say that the other thing that's really helped me this year in particular is that instead of looking at everything like I'm trying to accomplish all of these things this year, instead I separated the year into quarters. And so I'm just focusing on a specific thing each quarter. So like right now, from now until April, I'm just focusing on this documentary because that is my main focus. And yeah, Butterfly is coming out. So that means that now I've got a little bit of extra things that have been added to the mix as far as some things I need to help with. Obviously, there's some really exciting, we're premiering at Vidiots in April. So I've got like some things on the calendar, which is happening with that. But I'm also like, this documentary is my focus. And so I've allowed some writing projects and some acting projects to be put on pause right now. And then come April, I actually have an acting project that I'm going to be filming. So like, then I'm going to shift my focus and work on that. So I think it's also just like giving myself a lot of grace and knowing that things are going to fall through the cracks. And I think that the only positive part of everything else that's going on in the industry, like all of the shit that is happening, is that it just reminds me that like this, it's an ever-changing beast and it is going to get better and it's going to get worse and it's going to change all the time. And I just have to find some way to maintain my cool and last through it.
Right. It's a long game, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Something I read about in your bio that was incredibly intriguing to me is that right out of graduation, you started a construction company. Mm-hmm. So this entrepreneurial attitude has been with you, I assume, your whole life. And can you talk about that? Because most artists I know that they're artists from like a super young age. It sounds like you created, I don't want to use words like plan B or safety net, but I'm just saying like a sustainability loop for yourself at an early age as well.
Yeah. I mean, so I like to the full story of that is that like I did go to school for act. I mean, I was like a big theater nerd in high school. My undergrad degree was in English Lit and Theater. So I was a creative person. I ended up moving to Australia for a few different reasons. One of which, because I was very safety net oriented and I was like, I'm going to get a master's degree. That way, if I ever decide to teach, I will already have that bump in salary. My mom is a teacher. And so I was like, this is a good business plan, basically. Applied to all sorts of schools in the US, was like thinking about going to NYU, looked at the cost of NYU and was like, absolutely not. I worked 4 jobs to get through college without debt. I was like, I'm not going to do that. And, you know, so I ended up moving to Australia because they have a much cheaper programs there because so much of it is subsidized by the government. And so I got a master's in film production in Australia, met my ex-husband who's in construction. And then that was 2010. So it was like still post the world is onto it, you know, like great recession. And so at that point, I was like, well, I might as well stay in Australia and make a little money. And to be honest, I really enjoyed it. We had a construction engineering surveying business and I lived in the outback and I ran that with him for 4 years. We had like 25 employees and Yeah, it was wild, but it was something that was, I really did think that that was going to be my thing. And then after about 3.5 years in, I started to have some like really weird, I started having like hot flashes. I started feeling faint. Like there was a bunch of different things that were happening with me. Now I fully attribute it to a panic attack. I think I was having a months long panic attacks because my body was like, what the fuck are you doing? You shouldn't be in construction. And so from that, I ended up going to NIDA. I was like, oh, I forgot acting. I love that. And so I went to NIDA in Australia and then was like, oh, right, this is what I should be doing. I should not be running a construction company. And so then I moved back to LA almost 10 years ago and from that construction company. But I will say that was definitely something where like, again, I was like, I'm going to build in a safety net. And then even moving back to LA, that's why I started a marketing company. Because I was like, okay, I need to have, for me, I could never be an artist who lives out of their car and cannot pay rent. Like that, I can't be creative in that space. And that's something I knew about myself early on and was like, I need to figure out other ways in order to sustain my life. And then within that, I will be able to be my most creative self.
I have a bunch of questions. I think this one, I have one I really want to ask, but I'm going to save it for later. But Okay. Basically, so knowing that, you know, you're looking at the industry and it's like, okay, that there's not a lot of money to be made at the indie level right now. And it's going to get worse before it gets better. What is your end game in filmmaking? Like, what are you looking to achieve? Is it just to continue making projects at a whatever cost while you provide for yourself through your day job or your other means? Or is there some other kind of thing you're chasing as an artist?
That's a great question. And I would say that it changes all the time, depending upon my mood and like how, because I would say that like my goal most days is to leave my day job behind and to just focus on like to have the ability to say no to anything that does not creatively fulfill me and be like, this is going to be my thing. I'm going to just make movies and accept, you know, whatever. At the same time, I know that that is probably not realistic, especially as the times keep changing. And so most days I'm like pretty resigned to the fact that I'm going to continue to create things and have this side job for the foreseeable future. I would say the things that drive me, though, honestly, are the current climate. Like I have a feature that I'm writing right now with my boyfriend, who is also a writer. He's an incredible writer. And it's called Trigger Shot. And it's about a woman who freezes her eggs. And she drives cross country from LA to New York in order to freeze her eggs. And the reason she goes to New York is because it's much cheaper to freeze your eggs in New York than it is in Los Angeles. And the reason I know this is because this is something that I looked into. And the reason that I chose New York, this is actually an actual clinic in New York. There's multiple, there's a few of them. They have one, like the same company has one in Colorado, Arizona, Texas, and Florida. And when I was looking into this, I was like, there is no way in hell I'm going to have my eggs in Colorado, in Texas, in Florida, in Arizona. New York was the only option there. And so that was something where, especially with what's happening this week with Alabama and, you know, the IVF stuff, like that project is now so important for me for us to get that finished and for us to make that film happen, because there's also a ovarian cancer like C story in there. And I think that it's so important to talk about like female reproductive, what is currently in jeopardy, and just women's health in general. And so I would say that like for me, I would prefer to keep working my day job and push these projects forward so that I could then potentially put $100,000 into a feature film if I had to, my own feature film if I had to, because it has to, like, the story has to be told. For me, that's just like super, super important, rather than, that's why, you know, like I've had lots of friends. I've been recruited before to be like, you should work in the studio. Like you should, you know, you should be a producer on whatever. And, you know, I've been offered those positions before and I've always said no. Actually, right after Butterfly in the Sky, I was offered a really big producer job for Netflix, for a documentary for Netflix. And it was a really difficult decision, but I turned it down because it would have been 3 years of my life and I wouldn't have been able to work on any of my own projects. And for me, not just as because I'm also an actor and a writer and those things fuel me so much, but just because I'm like, you know what? I don't know if I care about your story enough to put 3 years of my life on hold when I have stories that I think are super important to be told right now.
I love that answer. I also want to ask about how, you know, we're talking about the state of the industry, the state of the economy, and how it's impacting the writing and the producing that you do in your day job. But how was the strike and upcoming strikes? How are you viewing them from your perspective as an actress? And, you know, even the virtual audition process and like getting on tape rather than going in person. I mean, so sorry. All the changes that have happened in the past few years, I'd be curious how those impact your creative process as a performer.
I mean, I love being in person in the room because I love interacting with people. So certainly that has been something that has been detrimental for me. But I've also always been someone who's the majority of my roles have been from stuff that I've created or from projects that my friends have been doing, excuse me, or like other people, like I get referred to a lot of people a lot. So it honestly hasn't impacted me that much because I've really built a foundation of people who support me and want to work with me. And so that doesn't change when it comes to the strike. And that's something where like, whenever I talk to actors, upcoming actors or whatever, and they, or creatives in general, filmmakers in general, when they say like, you know, like I'm not being called or, you know, like whatever. And I'm like, just find your people, just find your community of people that you want to work with. And that's it, because hopefully those people won't go anywhere, or they will, and things will change and you'll find new people or whatever. But like I ended up shooting two different projects during the strikes because they were friends' projects that then got waivers for. They were not cast, but like it was literally just people that were like, hey, I want you to come and play. And, you know, that those are also situations where I honestly get respected and paid usually more from, you know, because when you build a community of people with skills that you want to love and respect and it's reciprocal, then like, of course I pay my friends when they act in my projects and, you know, vice versa, or we do some kind of exchange, that kind of thing. Like it's just becomes a bartering system of not just funds, but also just favors and all of that kind of stuff. And I think that's true independent filmmaking is just like, you know, all boats rise with the tide, but also just like helping each other out as much as possible, however you can, is really important.
So I wanted to ask about producing versus co-producing and even versus associate producing. Like I see you have like lots of different producing credits. Like, is it literally like the based on the amount of work that you do, or are there more politics involved? Because I feel like sometimes like I've been a co-producer on a project where I was like basically doing the same amount of work as a producer, but like I don't get that credit because of whatever reason, you know?
Yep.
But is that your experience, or is there a different way that this has worked out?
Nope. I think it's entirely based on politics, at least for me. I think that in the studio system, there is certainly designations. And in the PGA, I'm in the PGA. And like in the PGA, there is designations as far as like when you get considered an associate producer versus co-producer, et cetera. But for the most part, it's just the politics. I would say this new documentary that I'm producing, which quick pitch for that one, because it's very aligned with everything that we're doing, with everything that we're talking about, because it's about two friends where one friend sold his house in order to fund his friend's first feature film. And so it's kind of like American Movie, that documentary from like the 90s, where it's just like quirky filmmakers who just love filmmaking and like what happens when one guy literally sold his house in order to make a film. Is he going to have a house at the end of the movie? Like that's what the documentary is. And that's why it keeps changing, because things are evolving all the time with that film. But when that project came to me, that was one where the two directors on that, one of them is a friend of mine that I went to high school with. And when I signed contracts with them, I was like, I want main producer credit on that film, because I really am the main producer. I'm the most experienced person in the group. So I'm really helping make that film happen. So with that one, they're also going to get producer credits, but I'm getting the first producer credit, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But again, it's so much of it is just they, I mean, because it's also something where sometimes people will be like, we can't pay you, but we'll give you whatever, or we'll give you this title bump instead. Like that happens all the time.
This interview is starting to feel a little bit like you're our life coach and you have all the answers.
Oh my
And
God.
like, I'm kind of putting you in that position in my mind where I'm like, well, she really has figured her shit out. Like, it's pretty impressive. I wanted
I'm
to
so
ask,
humbled.
well, it's true. It's TJ. I'm like, I should ask her, like, what's the point of existence? Like, that should be on our But my question instead is, I saw that you started a mental health nonprofit, which I think feels really germane to what I just said a minute ago. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's organization and a podcast called More Than You See, and it's evolved over the years as everything has. It's something that I started actually during COVID, but not because of COVID. It started because my ex-husband, who I ran the construction company with, him and I split up very dramatically and suddenly in February of 2019, and then that proceeded to lead me into the most dark, depressive period of my life. And because of that, the thing that really helped me pull out of that was listening to other people's stories about their depression and mental health. And this was like right at the start when people were starting to talk about their mental health, but like really not as much. And so it was so interesting to me that even though I had a therapist, the thing that made me feel the most part of the community was listening to these podcasts with people, specifically Zachary Levi, talking about how when he booked Shazam, he was like the most depressed that he was
Yes.
almost suicidal.
Yeah.
And so that was something like it is a goal of mine to have him on the podcast and at some point in the future, that is my ultimate goal because he truly and like him talking about it was so instrumental for me to get out of and to just know that the only way was through and it was going to be okay. And when I started talking to my friends about it, it was so interesting because they would be like, eh, I don't like listening to podcasts. I like listening to books or I like reading poetry or whatever. And I was like, oh, we all have different ways of processing our depression, our anxiety, what is going on in our brain. And I wanted to highlight that we all have so many different ways that we work through things. And it's really important for you to figure out what works for you. So the podcast is where I have creative conversations with actors, filmmakers, whomever, songwriters, and we talk about their careers and like all of the things that you would hear on a normal podcast. But then I also ask them questions about like, what do you do if you have a show that you have to perform and you don't want to get out of bed that morning? Like, what do you do? Because I think that oftentimes in these conversations, people skip over that and they're like, oh, you were sad that day. Okay, yeah, I'm sad too sometimes. And I'm like, no, I want to hear what were the mechanics of how you managed to get yourself out of bed? Because sometimes I feel that way, and I know other people are listening to that and feel that way. And so that's why I really, More Than You See is really about how like we all have all these identities, but we also have so much more going underneath us. And I want to make sure that we highlight that.
So I want to hear a little bit more about this Netflix job that you turned down, just because I've been in those situations in my career. And I know that you gave a really great answer about like why you made the decision that all makes sense. But do you feel like in the future, if those kinds of opportunities come along, that there's maybe like a world where like if you did put projects on hold for 3 years to work on this thing that could elevate your career and put you in a higher standing as a producer, open up more contacts, and also pay for, take over as your main job, but like that might be like a beneficial thing that kind of kills like two birds with one stone. Like not only is it gonna be that now your day job is your filmmaking, and also you're opening yourself up for bigger opportunities for your own projects in the future.
For sure. I mean, that's a very good point. I would say that for me, it was really number one because it was a documentary job. And at the time, I was like, I'm not going to produce another documentary. And then this new one came along and I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'll produce another documentary. But I really wasn't thinking I was going to. So sure, if it was something where like, I've produced lots of narrative films before, and if one of those what, like my last narrative film, you know, unfortunately, I'm saying in quotes, came out in June of 2020. And it's based on a true story, gut-wrenching story about a woman with terminal cancer. That is not what people wanted to watch during COVID, especially at the start. So like that was a film that like I really felt should have made a much bigger splash than it did. So sure, if that film came out and then Netflix offered me, you know, whatever in order to produce a narrative, I think that I would have been more open to it. But I think that for better or for worse, also the fact that I am an actor and a writer, I mean, specifically the actor part is something that like I'm very protective of that. And so if it meant that it was going to take me out of the running for, you know, acting creative projects that I had coming up, it would be very difficult for me to say yes, unless it was just an obscene amount of money or a project that I was just so passionate about, really, really loved the script or something like that. Like, of course, there is exceptions to the rule. But I also think that fortunately, because of the way I've structured my day job, I am fairly comfortable with juggling all of these different things. And so I'm kind of okay to keep coasting the way that it's going until something really big kind of pulls me out of that.
You and I mainly talk to each other with regard to distribution. Like that's the main topic that you and I have connected on. And having run a marketing company, also being an actress, requires a massive amount of understanding of audience building and marketing. Be curious what your advice is for other filmmakers with regard to growing your audience in distribution.
I think that the thing that I always tell people is to know your audience.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/westwoodone, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/westwoodone now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/westwoodone.
It's from the beginning. Know your audience from the script stage, because I think that that's something where people think, especially because then when you're looking at casting, when you're looking at the colors you're going to choose on screen, all of that, you make a different decision based on the audience that you know is going to be watching the film. A great example is I have a friend who makes a lot of faith-based family films. And so that was something where like when she goes into projects, even though it's a teen film, she knows that a lot of the audience of her past films have been Christian teens or Christian filmmaker, you know, aficionados. And so she'll cast a YouTube star who is specifically a Christian YouTube star. And she is the only person that I am really good friends with who has consistently, she's made 9 feature films and all of them have been 100% paid back.
Has she been on our show before? Because I feel like you're talking about Alexandra Boylan.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Oh, man. Alexandra. Yeah. She's great.
Yeah. And so, I mean, like, that's where it's like, she's someone who is so incredible about knowing exactly who the audience is from the beginning. And so that's definitely something where when I talk to filmmakers, I'll be like, okay, I know that you really want, like, that you think that, like, this B-list star who is the lead of this Netflix show is, like, your person because he has 5 million followers. But, like, he's a, like, I don't know, rough and tumble cowboy type, and you're actually looking for like someone more city, whatever, you know, like go for someone with a bit of a less of a following, but like people are actually going to be aligned with that actor. Like, I think that that's super, super important. And so that's certainly something when it comes to me and my more than you see and all of that kind of stuff, where like I just try to live in authenticity as far as like this is who I am. So like if you want me, then that's what you're getting, you know? Like I can morph into a lot of different characters, but like at my core, people kind of know that I'm like a badass with a heart of gold. That's what people kind of know me as. And so like that can then transform into a bunch of different characters, but like I'm not a like trash talking whatever. Like that's not my character, you know, as a person. So I think that that's really, really important. I would also say, you know, people undermine or like don't pay attention to their hometowns and don't put enough onus on the fact that there is that people get really excited about films still. I think that we can get very jaded when we're in bigger markets and we think that like no one cares about film anymore, but that's not true. And so, you know, going back to your hometown, having, you know, four-walling a screening in your hometown, like all of that kind of stuff, that word of mouth is still really, really powerful. And I think that people kind of discount that. So I would say that as well.
So I want to sneak in one last question before we get to our final questions.
Yeah.
So you mentioned before that you were like, I don't want to be a director, I want to be a producer. And then recently on your documentary sets that you're like, oh, like maybe I could be or want to be the director, you know? But is that something that's you're thinking about in the narrative realm as well? Did that kind of open up your mind to that possibility? Or do you kind of feel like, no, I still want to be actor, producer, mainly on whatever, narrative features I work on in the future?
Yeah. I mean, I would say never, but I'm such a collaborative person. So like I want to have other voices in the room. And so like I know that acting is very important. And so for me, that's like pretty high up on the list. And then I do love producing. I love the organization and the creative and all that kind of stuff. So like I would say those two are still my mains. And then, I mean, I would always be open to it, but it's something where like with Trigger Shot, we're planning my boyfriend and I, like he's writing it, I'm starring in it. It's a road trip movie, so like we know that we could do it for as cheap as possible. Like we would, if we had to do it, that's how we would do it. We also have some thoughts about how we're gonna put it around some production companies that we know to potentially have co-productions. But if that doesn't happen, we're just gonna make it happen. And then the plan is for him to direct it. Because again, like I just think that like it's so important to have multiple voices in a room in order to tell a story. I think a movie gets rewritten so many times in so many different ways, and it's so important to have those other voices to bring different perspectives to a film.
All right, it is time for final six questions, which sometimes turn into like final five, final four. Let's see how much time we have left. What's the first film you ever made? And you can interpret that in any way. How do you feel about it now?
I shot some Yelp commercials when I was in Australia with a DP who I still actually then ended up coming to AFI, and he's like my favorite DP that I love working with. And that was something where it was like, I love watching them because I was so excited about like being on set. And like, I can tell watching those commercials that like, that is what I was supposed to be doing. Cause just like my infectious excitement just like comes through the screen. So I love them.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
I would say figure out what is your crazy. And by that, I mean, what is the thing that is going to keep you from being creative? Because again, for me, I know that I need financial stability in order to be creative. For other people, they don't need financial stability. They need the chaos in order to be creative. And for other people, you know, maybe they need to work really hard and then quit for a few weeks in order to be creative. But I just think that it's so important to figure out your brand of crazy and own it and stick to it. I mean, until it evolves into something else. But I think it's so important that people listen to other filmmakers and they're like, ooh, I should do that, or I should be like that, or like whatever. But like, that doesn't align with who you are and like what drives you, then it can be something where you file it away and be like, that might be a note for next time, or that just doesn't work with me. And like, that's okay. Cause that's what makes this career in this industry so fascinating, is there's so many different ways that we all work, and that's what makes this all work together.
What's some really bad advice you've heard or experienced?
I think don't read contracts, or like, people are like, all contracts are the same. Then they are not. Yeah, there was something, I was reading something the other day, like a contract that I'm helping with, and I was like, I cannot believe that someone handed this to you and said that this was a good idea, because it's actually like completely crippling for the project. And I was like, this is terrible. We need to get a lawyer to rewrite this. So yeah, read your contracts, folks, and read them yourself. Like, they're not that hard. Like, yes, you should get someone else in order to come in and give advice with things. But like, if you don't understand a word, like, look it up. Like, it's really easy to kind of at least get the feel of what's going on, and you'll just develop a way to be like, nope, this doesn't work, etc.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
I mean, my goal as a filmmaker is to be a series regular on a show, and then to continue to create and develop my own projects on the side, like during hiatus period.
Wow.
I don't know if you are friends with Luke Barnett. I'm only friends with him on Twitter. His tweet recently was like, when I am a series regular on CSI Milwaukee, I'm going to take $100,000 every summer and make a movie and hire a writer to write a character that I just really want to play.
Yep.
It resonated with me. I was like, yeah, that's why aren't we seeing those projects? If you could go back in time, what's the piece of advice you'd give yourself? Meet Luke Barnett? I don't know. Go on.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe. I need to align myself with him. I would say, and this is something I would say that I struggle with all the time, especially as an actor and as a filmmaker in general, is that age is just a number. Because especially as a woman, it's something that I, you know, struggle with all the time, as far as like, what characters can you play? What, you know, like, you're too old to whatever. And I think that that is a fallacy, and it's something that we have been forced to believe in because of society. And I want to just kind of, you know, both tell myself now and tell myself 10 years ago when I first moved to LA that like, it's going to be okay. No matter what age you are, you're just going to continue to creating. Like, this isn't going to stop once you hit 35. Like, and that's the way that it should be.
Last question. Is making movies hard?
It is, but it is the best. It is the reason I get out of bed.
Promote yourself, promote everything, the 45 million things that you do. This is your soapbox. Go.
Yay. I mean, basically, you can Google me and find me. I'm pretty easy, Deverly Smith. You can find me on Instagram. That will link to the projects that I'm working on, as well as More Than You See, my podcast. And I would strongly encourage anyone who wants to listen to like creative conversations with people where we really just like talk about their day-to-day life and like how they function and how they succeed and how they fail and all of those things. Like, I think that we do a really good job of that on the podcast, and I would love to have more community over there. So come join me.
Auric, what do you remember about our chat with Deverly Smith?
Well, she's really impressive. And I mean, I know that's like a really basic statement, but I'll try to get more detail on it. But like, she had her whole career kind of like lined out in a way that I thought was really impressive, and that she took jobs in a way that would allow her to continue to be a creative and work. Not just a creative, but like to work in this industry and do the things that she wanted to do. So it's like she kind of had it all like figured out, like a kind of like a puzzle. Like, she's like, I'm going to produce this project. It's going to pay me this much. And then I'm going to take this job and then it'll pay me less, but it's going to allow me to do this. And it's like she had this whole way of like setting up her career, and like that was really cool, you know. And it was like, damn, like, why don't I do that? Like, why don't I like figure out like how I can like, you know, edit this movie and like it pays for this job, and then direct this movie for no money, and then do this and then move it around and like figure it out, you know. And it's like, and then take this day job thing for this length of time to do this, you know. It's like all these different things that she did in order to like allow her career to exist, and then like how it felt like she had like a lot of freedom in like what she did as an artist and as a actor, producer, you know, and I just felt like that was really cool. Yeah, it was just really inspiring. I feel like for anyone who wants to get into this business, it was like a really great conversation to like hear the many different ways you can go about it.
Yeah, Deborah has this, I hope I'm using this word properly, like ineffable quality to her where you're just like, oh, I just like you. Like I think it's confidence. And she also knows that, right? She mentioned in the interview that like, I don't know, there's an easy way with her that helps her with collaborations, I think. I hope I'm paraphrasing that. But I just am a fan of hers. I was so glad she went on the podcast. And the reason she was on the podcast, there was a glaring error. Like I posted on Twitter, like, we need some ladies on the podcast. And she like raised her hand. And then I was like, why hadn't I asked Deborah before? I feel foolish. So it was an oversight, Deborah, if you're listening to this now. And we're grateful that you are part of our little community now.
Yes, agreed. Co-signed. That's the word I was looking for, co-signed. But what was it's time for today, which I'm very, very excited. It was delayed last week. We didn't get to do one last week. We get to do one today. It's time for The Game. And for those who are listening to the podcast for the very first time, The Game is something that Eric Toms, our producer, created, where he comes up with like a challenge, like an indie film, you know, scenario challenge, quagmire, we say sometimes, that like we have to solve. Because, you know, everything goes wrong on sets all the time. You never know what's going to happen. And it's just a really fun way to come up with, you know, what you would do in this given situation. So Eric wrote this question. Liz has not heard it before. It is brand spanking new. So here we go. You've been working for the past few years and have made some real strides in your career. You've directed two low-budget feature films that you raised funds for yourself, and they did very well on the festival circuit, both finding distribution. This sounds really familiar. Your last film not only broke even, but made a little money and got the notice of some producers in Hollywood. However, all of this has come at a price. You've strained your bank account and are nearly broke. To make things worse, you've been away from your house for weeks at a time, which has made things difficult on your relationship with your partner. One day you get a call you've been waiting for your whole career. A studio is calling to hire you for a feature film. Whoa. It's a very low budget by their standards, but a fortune as far as you're concerned. You'll make scale plus money on the back end. It'll be enough to cover your bills for the next year, but it'll mean long hours away from home again. You talk it over with your partner. They claim they're okay with the travel and time apart, but you have your concerns. Oh my God. Do you, A, take the job and do your best to make it up to your partner later? B, decline the job as your relationship could fall apart as a result? C, just break up now. Oh my God. And maybe the two of you will reconcile down the road and your situation changes. D, other. What do you do, director? What do you do?
Do you want to hear something funny? Like, this question feels fairly low stakes to me now that I have kids. I'm like, oh, it's just my partner? Oh, okay. Like, I wasn't thinking. And I love my husband. But I was like, oh, there's no kids involved? Oh, well, you know, like, when you don't have children, your relationship has to either stand the strains of what you're going through, or it's the wrong relationship, right? So, I mean, that's my assumption, is like, if we're already strained and I allowed that strain to happen, why am I not fighting for this relationship? Maybe I would just make this movie and just continue to strain the relationship and see if testing it breaks it or it gets stronger. Does that make sense to you? Like, if there were kids involved, this would be a whole different question to me. But because it's just my partner, I would think, yeah, I would probably make the movie and just try to see them on weekends and vacations and FaceTime and bring them to set and just do my best to keep the relationship afloat. But having the vantage that I have right now with kids, like, I wouldn't do that with kids. Like, I wouldn't take the film if we had kids, me and my partner, right? But in this question, kids are not mentioned.
Okay, well, let's just, for fun, if there were kids,
I wouldn't take it.
You wouldn't take it.
No, because you have like a broken home potentially on your hands. And then what about your poor kids and the stability of their life? And it's like, it doesn't say that I love this movie. It just says that it's a job and that it would pay my bills. And I would start to think like, I shouldn't wrap my children and their future up in like a financial gamble. I could get fired from this studio film. There's no guarantee that I'm going to be a part of this project. There's too much at risk to gamble it with a family. But with a partner, I feel like I would want the type of partner who would grant me that latitude to explore this job.
Yeah, totally.
What about you?
I kind of feel like, if you don't have kids.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I mean, if you're married, is it the same? Or does it change if you're married? Or either way.
Sean and I were together for like 10 years before being married. So to me, it was like,
so you don't really care. It's the same.
Didn't matter. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you? You're going to be nicer to your partner. I feel like you're nicer.
I just feel like I'm just going to imagine it's Beth before movie, before kids.
Yeah.
And I'll answer that part of it first. So I think I would do it because there's no way that she wouldn't support me to do it because. Right. This is what I've been working for forever, and what I've all the sacrifices I've made up until now have been for this opportunity. So of course she would have supported it. And if our relationship was a little rocky at the time, I think time apart might even be good. like it might be okay to like have a little bit of a breather and then come back. But yeah, I would take the job and make it up to my partner later. But I mean, I also, this question says that they say to do it, that they're supporting you to do the movie.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like, yeah,
do the movie.
Do it for sure. If kids are involved, I would have to make sure that the kids were involved in some way, you know, that I wasn't going to be away from them for a month or whatever without any contact, that like we would all go together to make this movie, or that there would be some sort of system in place that Beth and I were both happy with, that I could get to be with them while making the movie, you know? And if she said, oh my God, no, just go away, we'll be fine, come back, then I would have to reconsider. Because if I can't be around them while they're this young for a month, that's pretty big deal.
Yeah, I'm not doing that.
It's probably not worth it, you know, to be away from your kids for a month or more when they're under four. You know, it just seems,
I think there's
tough.
A difference. Like if the question were framed like, this is a big budget film from an Academy Award winning writer from a, you know, if the variables are set up where this could be a life-changing experience where you could forgive yourself and maybe your kids could forgive you for the absence. You know what I mean? Like if this was a story or a project that meant the world to you, then that's a different argument than this is a studio's least important project is what it sounds like. Like where there's not a real investment in you or the film.
Yeah. Well, so I'm just looking up DGA scale, low budget for like the lowest budget that it could be.
Right. But I'm not DGA, right? So
I'm just saying this is what I'm... But low budget studio feature, you're going to get a DGA-ish rate on it.
Okay.
In that realm, you know. Let's say it's over, for fun, let's say it's over 3.75 million. So it's like a $4 million feature.
Okay.
So you would be getting roughly $15,000 a week to make
And that's
movie.
Like such a huge difference in my life. That would be monumental, life-changing, but...
And you get guaranteed 2 weeks of prep, and then you get a guaranteed 10-week employment period.
No,
so
I
it'd
can't.
Be 10 weeks of $15,000. So you'd make $150,000 plus minimum for 10 weeks of time. And that's not necessarily saying that you have to be away for 10 weeks. That just means that you have to be employed for 10 weeks and that, you know, you could be gone for a month. You could be gone for 3 weeks. You know, you don't really know like what it is. But like, I'm just saying when it gets to that level, you know, basically it is life changing. Even if it is a shitty low budget studio feature, it is life changing because now you're a studio feature director and you're directing features for studios. right? Like that's like your baseline. It's right. completely life.
If that's what you want to do with your life. Like I applied for the Hallmark directing fellowship last night. It's called Make Her Mark. Fun. And it's because you know I love fun. I like would that's, love
that's,
to direct.
That's your jam. That's amazing.
I would love to direct a Christmas movie. I'm actually in the midst of like developing a few of them. So we'll see. But part of me was like, should I even apply to this? Because like yes. if I got it, then I'd have to be away. And so it's like, you know how I guess this is my crux and you're like my issue with you is always like, say no to people. And I feel like your issue with me is like, say yes to things. Like I'm hearing that from you, like make a more pragmatic decision. But I don't think $150,000 is enough for me to make that exchange to like really.
For 2.5 months of like, having a little bit of a tough time with the family, you know.
I don't know if I could.
For $150,000 and the idea that, like, now you're going to be, you're not necessarily guaranteed to be a full-time filmmaker for the rest of your life, but the chances of you being
right, but then I'm just going to be in that situation for the rest of my life. It's going to be another project.
2 months out of a year, 2 months out of a year that you're going to be gone to not have to work.
I mean, I think if someone
the year,
if it was real,
you don't have to work.
Okay. If it was real, if it was a real thing, I probably would react differently. But hypothetically, like it's a no for me. In actuality, I would make probably a different decision, but it's hard for me to see that.
I don't know. I feel like if it's $150,000 that you make for one movie and that you only have to be gone for potentially, let's say the worst case scenario, 2 months, and you could probably bring your family with you for a portion of it. It's like, it seems like you kind of have to try to figure out how to make it work, you know?
But I see because then you don't have to work day. For the rest.
You don't have to work anymore.
But my kids.
I don't have to do this shit anymore, you know? Come on, man. I'm not get to see them all day, every day for 10 months.
I don't think you That's would. Like, I think after this project, you'd be like, where's my next hit? What's my next thing? What am I going to do?
You're stressed out. I'm going to get my next movie within 4 months of shooting my last? No way. I would have to be like so hot snot cold boogers to for that to happen.
What's that expression?
Hot snot and cold boogers is what we say in our family. I don't know where that came from.
I know.
But anyways, you'd have to be in such high demand to like for that to happen, you know. And if it did happen. Well, then that's another conversation. But like then at that point, you can turn something down because you know another one's going to come. So I don't know. I just think that like this is a big deal and it's not to be taken lightly, you know. And I think it's in the easy answer with no kids. With kids, it's harder. But I still think like I'd have to try to figure out how to make this work as long as it didn't mean I was going to get divorced. If it meant I was going to get divorced, then I wouldn't do it. But if it didn't mean that, if like we could work through this and I had support of my partner, then yes, then I would do it.
I mean, I'm not even thinking about the divorce. I'm thinking like not seeing. I'm like, whatever. We'll probably get divorced someday. but it's like my kids. Not seeing my kids every single day freaks me out. And I think, yeah, it's I have to get over it. I get it.
I mean, eventually you're not going to see them every day.
But there's I'm going to live with them and I'm going to live in their basements. I'm going to like live down the street. I'm going to be that mother. Man. Yeah. Have you seen me at a school concert, Ulrich? It's like a little cuckoo crazy.
Not yet.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's hilarious.
I am like a one woman like cheering squad for my child.
Okay. Well, here we go. Let's wrap this up. People, what would you do in this situation? Kids, no kids, whatever. We want to know. This is a really fun question. Eric, thank you very much. Got a lot of energy going off of this one. But you can send us those thoughts or any other questions, comments, or suggestions to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Or if you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes, which would be great. Or a rating is also really great. You can check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. A big thanks to Deborah Lee Smith for coming on the show. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimuth, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for handling all of our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for simply being awesome. Thanks to you all for listening, and we'll talk to you all next week.
Listen to your podcast, I know that.
He's a lovely freak.
I love how relaxed you are. It's amazing. It's some people come in and are like, oh, I don't want that. You know, so.
It's so calming. It's like, what is it like being like that? That sounds so nice. You're just on top of things and charming.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, didn't see that coming, and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.